KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
And welcome to another edition of KSL at Night. I'm your host this evening, Greg Skordis. I am KSL's legal analyst and attorney of the last 42 years. KSL's had me on board for a small portion of that, but I've enjoyed my stay here, and KSL has been very, very kind to let me host this show. Usually, if you listen to KSL at Night, you know that we have two hosts. Tonight, I'm riding solo, so we will be listening to me, but luckily I have some guests that will help fill a lot of this show, and that's good for me because a lot of people don't like to listen to me for 2 hours straight. At any rate, I actually taught a class yesterday at the courts, and it was a 3-hour class, and these kids were all probation officers listening to me, and I could just tell by the end of that class that the eyes were glazing over a little bit. Nonetheless, I'm looking at some pictures today, and this is really wild. A cargo ship in Baltimore ran into a bridge, and how that happened and why it happened, we're going to learn in just a minute with our next guest. But the footage of this thing is just horrific. There are some people missing. We'll talk about that, how it happened and why it happened. We'll also learn. In fact, instead of me telling you what we're going to learn, let's just learn about it. We are joined this evening by Andy Field, ABC News correspondent, who's going to help us break this down. Andy, thank you for joining us this evening. And tell us what we know so far about the bridge.
Well, this happened about 1:30 in the morning Eastern time. There was a work crew on the bridge basically patching potholes while a giant cargo ship was leaving the port of Baltimore heading back out to sea under the guidance of a pilot that works the local waters there to help guide them through the bridges and other navigation problems that they might face. At some point just before they got to the bridge, there was a mayday call from that boat to the Coast Guard saying, "We've lost power and the ability to steer the boat." Instead of going under the bridge, that boat then plowed directly into one of the giant pylons holding up one end of the bridge, which then collapsed the whole thing. Fortunately, that emergency call they made it to the Coast Guard and then to the transportation people who were up on either end of the bridge, knowing that there was road work there. And this is the call that one of those transportation officers made to everyone else on either side of the bridge.
Hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering. So until you get that under control, we got to stop all traffic.
Now, that call came just before 1:30 in the morning. Immediately, police pulled in and stopped traffic on both ends of the bridge. Didn't stop some cars from getting on there, and it appears that some of them may have fallen into the water. We're still not clear on that. But between that call and then literally less than 2 minutes later, this is what they heard.
313 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Everybody, the whole bridge just collapsed.
Just a chilling call to get on your radio. We received that audio via Broadcastify. And from there, you can see the video online where the lights go out on the boat. They come back on. It crashes into the bridge, and then the entire bridge collapses. It's a giant, very high bridge. I've driven over it hundreds of times. And it is the main north-south artery for commercial traffic because the other two ways to get through Baltimore going north are through tunnels that they don't allow that commercial traffic to go through. There is one other way to get around Baltimore, but it is a very long way around where you have to swing far west of the city and then come back out north and hit 95 again. It probably adds an hour, hour and a half to that drive and certainly delays things and makes travel a lot more costly, which is what's going to happen now for the foreseeable future.
So, Andy, describe this bridge. It's interesting that you've been on it and you're familiar with it. It's a fairly wide bridge that can handle a lot of traffic, it sounds like, if it's one of the main arteries that gets people from A to B across that particular river.
Well, it's not that wide, but it's long. And if I recall, I think it's two, maybe three lanes on each side. And the reason it was built was, it was built back in the 70s, so it's about almost 50 years old. There's never been any construction issues with it, maintenance issues with it. It's not one of those rotting away bridges that we hear about in other places. And we've talked to engineers today who say it's a well-designed bridge. It's just the fact that to make a bridge that long across a very long span of water, you need to have all the sections connected, which is good for strength of the bridge when cars are going over it. Not so good if one of the supports at either end collapses, because they'll all go down.
So the bridge, and I guess I'm kind of dumb here. We don't have a lot of bridges in Utah. We don't have a lot of water in Utah. But it's made for there. It's not one of those bridges that rises and lowers as ships come and the bridge failed.
This is several hundred feet above the water.
Okay, and there are
high enough so that these large cargo ships can go under them.
And so this ship should have easily made it had it hit the right part of approach the bridge at the right section.
It wasn't the top of the ship that hit. It was the actual bow of the ship plowing into one of those big stanchions that hold up one end of the bridge.
And Andy, I think everybody wants to know what is the level of injury here? Are there people missing? Are there people presumed dead? Do we know anything about that? Because you said
the numbers are hard to tell right now because it's not clear how many cars may have been on the bridge. We were told earlier from the fire department that sonar indicates that there were some cars in the water. This is very deep water here because they needed to dig a very deep channel. The current is also very fast there. You've got water going from a bay to a smaller bay in a river into the large Chesapeake Bay. So the currents are very strong there. So even if someone fell in there, they could be swept away a very good distance, which is going to make the search much more difficult.
And I imagine that this time of year in Baltimore, it's also really cold. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that a person's going to survive very long.
I read somewhere that the water temperature is 45, 44 degrees. It's cold.
I was looking at some footage here, Andy, and we're joined this afternoon by Andy Field, ABC News correspondent, that shows that whatever the ship hit stopped it. So this pylon must have been pretty sturdy, not sturdy enough to hold up the bridge, but the ship came to a stop, and it's still sitting there, it looks like, from the pictures I can see.
Yeah, there's giant cement footings that hold these large steel girders that hold up the bridge. And, a lot of bridges are designed like this, at least from that era. They all seem to be designed pretty well. Maryland does a pretty good job of maintaining its bridges and roads. But, yeah, this was stunning. And to watch this video and see the bridge come down that quickly, it almost looks like it was a planned implosion and not someone hitting the bridge.
Oh, it just looks awful. We're talking about Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge, partially collapsed, you say, this morning about 1:30. So luckily, I guess, if there's any luck to this at all, it wasn't filled with traffic. And an additional sort of piece of luck was that the ship's captain was alert enough and able enough to understand what was going on that he called it in, and we heard that call. So the local authorities, law enforcement authorities, were apparently able to at least block new traffic from coming onto the bridge, but apparently there were still a car or two or some people left remaining on the bridge. We don't know that yet, do we?
Yeah, now going forward, there's a whole lot of challenges. One, the Port of Baltimore is essentially paralyzed now until they can remove the debris of that bridge so boats and ships can safely go in and out of that narrow passageway. And that is a giant hit to the economy, not just to Baltimore, because they've got 15,000 workers who are basically in charge of that port, unloading goods and services and packing them up to be shipped elsewhere. It's also the biggest and busiest port for auto imports and exports in this country. So that's going to be a giant hit on the economy. It's going to create some shortages with cars along the East Coast and even further into the Midwest. And then, of course, as we mentioned, the trucks are not going to be able to use this route anymore for several years. It takes years to build a bridge like this.
Wild. And looking at the footage of this, it's just horrific. Andy Field, if you don't mind staying with us, we're going to come back with you after the break and talk about the Supreme Court. Are you good with that?
Sure.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm your host this evening, Greg Skordis, KSL's legal analyst. And we have a legal matter that we're talking about in the press today, and that is that the United States Supreme Court heard arguments today regarding the drug and the regulation of the drug, mifepristone, a pill that is used for abortion purposes. And we'll sort of break that down a little bit here. But it's something that, you know, we've had so much going on with the Supreme Court and with our states after the Dobbs decision. That's been, 2.5, 3 years, different states trying to decide what they want to do. And now we're getting into the real early stages, talking about mifepristone. To help us break that down, we have Andy Field, ABC News correspondent, who was with us for the last segment. Andy, thank you for staying with us.
Sure. Yeah, this is an important story because, as you mentioned, ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and threw everything back into the state's laps, we've been getting a whole rash of court cases like this that ended up back in the Supreme Court. This one in particular is a bit of a unicorn because, as Justice Kagan asked one of the lawyers who were arguing that the FDA overstepped its bounds, she said to that lawyer, to the government's knowledge, is this the first time, is it the only time any court has restricted access to the FDA to an FDA-approved drug by second-guessing the FDA's expert judgment about conditions required to use the drug safely? And the government answered, to our knowledge, it's the only time any court's done that. So that's why this is a bit of a unicorn case. And from what, you know, if you want to read the tea leaves in the Supreme Court when you listen to and watch the case. And one of the nice things now is that anyone can listen to the arguments. It used to be that sometimes they let these tapes out a long time later. Now you can listen to this live. And it seemed like most of the justices on the court, including the most conservative justices, seemed highly skeptical that the anti-abortion drugs that said the FDA overstepped its bounds even had any right to be there to argue this case, that there was no harm done to them. And that's where we are with the case right now. And that was what most of the arguments were, not about whether we should use it, whether abortion's legal or not legal. It's whether these doctors really had any business bringing this lawsuit in the first place.
Interesting. So what we're talking about, Andy, is a challenge to the FDA's regulation of mifepristone. That is the FDA. And I know that that regulation has sort of changed over the years. I think they've dialed it back a little bit. But at its core, that's what we're talking about here, right?
Right. Here's the issue. In 2016 and then in 2021, the FDA expanded the allowable use of mifepristone, and this is the actual abortion drug. It's very different from the morning after pill. Mifepristone actually initiates a chemical abortion in a woman who's already pregnant. They allowed it now up to 10 weeks. Before it was just 7 weeks. They reduced the recommended dose and how many times you had to have in-person doctor visits. They let nurse practitioners as well as physicians prescribe it, and they permitted distribution by mail. Now, these doctors say all of those things that the FDA allowed has made their life as doctors much more difficult because they're getting called into emergency rooms to deal with complications of an abortion that didn't complete, and then they, against their philosophies, have to complete this abortion, which they say they're conscientious objectors and they shouldn't have to perform these procedures. Well, the government's arguing that it is so rare that any time there's a complication here, that there are plenty of other doctors that can do this and they don't have to be the ones to do these things. So they really have no case to argue that they're not being harmed by this. again, this it's a weird case because a lot of people listening to this were saying, well, you know, is the abortion drug legal or not? Are they going to ban it? And this case really isn't about that. It's about whether other doctors have to clean up a problem caused by a drug that they say the FDA is being too lenient in letting out there in the world.
So is it kind of a standing issue, Andy? Was it
absolutely.
Maybe these
it's
judges?
It's absolutely that.
These judges don't necessarily have a dog in the fight.
Yeah, which kind of begs the question, how did it get to the Supreme Court in the first place?
Yeah, well, because you use the A word, abortion, and everybody wants to get up to the Supreme Court as soon as they can. It seemed like there was a lot of, like you described, I mean, just looking at some of the people that were listening to the arguments, the Supreme Court seemed very skeptical of this argument made by these doctors for the reasons you've articulated here. It was across the board, right? There were not just the liberal justices, but there were some conservative ones that were also.
Well, two of the conservative justices, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, seemed very leery of reinstating any sweeping bans on the drug nationwide when only a handful of doctors were claiming they were hurt. Gorsuch said, quote, "The case seems like a prime example of turning what should be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other federal government action." So, you know, Gorsuch is not big on overreach here, and he thinks that that's exactly what they're doing. So, you know, I think Justice Alito and Clarence Thomas seem to be most interested in the abortion doctor side, but if that's the case, that's two against the entire Supreme Court, and it's likely that this is not going to go in the plaintiff's direction. And basically, you know, again, if we're placing odds in Las Vegas, everyone seems to think that this is not going to have any effect on the abortion pill whatsoever.
I understand also, Andy, that when the FDA relaxed its regulations on this particular drug, that it's now available in the mail. I mean, was that at all part of the argument today that maybe the FDA's
it's gone way too far? Right. Yeah. It's just that the anti-abortion doctors are saying that there's just too much of a liberal use of this thing, that a doctor can prescribe it over the mail, just have a cursory interview with a patient over the phone or telehealth, and then they just get it mailed to them and they can perform the abortion themselves. By the way, more than half of all abortions in this country are now done with this abortion pill.
Yeah, that's what's surprising to me. And you say, Andy, that the drug originally started out as something that had to be used or was prescribed to be used within the first 7 weeks. Now it's been, I guess, pursuant to the FDA's—
Up to 10 weeks.
So states that—and I'm not asking you to dig deep into the legal arguments here, but states that allow abortion within the first 10 weeks, this would be a pill that would be legal in those states.
Arguably. It would, and there's arguments that, you know, the states that have put 6-week abortion bans in there, that's where they're having big fights as well. This is not the only case going, but it's the big one that's gotten to us right now. Interestingly enough, there is a law on the books that bans distributing abortion efficients, abortion pills, by mail. It's called the Comstock Act. It's a 1873 federal law that banned distributing abortion pills by mail. It's rarely been invoked, but it's still in force. And Justice Thomas says, well, this law seems to be applying in your case here. It's unlikely the other justices are going to agree with that, but it's interesting that there is a federal law in the book that actually bans that distribution by mail.
1873, maybe we were distributing by Pony Express. I mean, the mail.
I'm not sure what they used in 1873.
I was going to say, well, who
Old
knows
thing?
What it was.
I mean, what did they use?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Andy, for joining us this evening on KSL at Night. You're always great to help us, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, Greg, thanks.
After the break, let's go to Idaho and talk about a trial that's starting next week involving Chad Daybell and how that's different than the Lori Daybell-Vallow trial just a year ago. Stay with us.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
And you're back with us on KSL at Night. I'm your host this evening, Greg Skordis, and I'm riding solo today. Next week, if you recall, about a year ago, we had the trial in Boise, Idaho of Lori Vallow. Next week is the trial involving her husband, Chad Daybell. And it's almost a year later, it seems like. I recall that one was about this time of year. Lori was tried. She was convicted. She was sentenced to multiple life sentences. I think she's down in Arizona now awaiting trial there for other homicides. But her husband Chad's trial is beginning next week on Monday. The cases were separated, if you recall, some time ago, in part because Lori had claimed that she was and actually had established that she was incompetent. That put her trial on hold. Chad was ready to move forward. And then it sort of switched around where Lori's competence was restored. Her case went to trial, but the state at the last minute, really within just the last week or two before that trial, decided that they were going to forego the death penalty on her case. They separated the two trials because Chad's case was still going forward as a death penalty case. And Lori, of course, went to trial. We know what happened there. So joining us this evening is Lauren Steinbrecher, KSL TV reporter who covered the Lori Vallow case. Lauren, thank you for joining us this evening.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me.
And talk to our listeners about just the atmosphere up there. You were there last year when the Lori Vallow trial went. And it's not a particularly small courthouse. I mean, it's Boise, Idaho. It's the biggest city up there, but there was a lot of hubbub. I mean, that courthouse was just packed with people. And just talk to our listeners about the atmosphere when you were up there last year.
Yeah. So, I mean, last year, a big factor was the fact that this trial wasn't live streamed in any way. There were no cameras or recording allowed in the courtroom. So the only way to really know, unless you were following, you know, someone along on Twitter or on X, was to be there in person and either to be in the courtroom itself or they had overflow rooms. And so people came in from around the country, not just journalists, but I mean, people who were following the case. You know, some who were, you know, more interested in true crime and stuff, but people were traveling to Boise just to be in that courtroom. And because of that, there were so many people, you know, outside standing in line, inside, you know, on breaks, a lot of chatter. I think we really saw that in the culmination of the verdict when, I mean, people were lining up in masses outside the courtroom, you know, cheering when that came down. And so it was a very lively atmosphere every single day with just all different kinds of walks of life. And so it's hard to know how it's going to be with Chad's trial because of that live streaming element. But I think, you know, in Lori's trial, you really had to be there in person to understand what was happening every day.
And you and I were there in person. I was only there for the first couple days. You probably covered more than that. Well, you obviously covered more than that. But I was in one of those overflow rooms and was able to watch it. It was live streamed for us in those rooms. Why do you think the judge decided to live stream this trial? And is it the same judge that Lori had?
Yes. Yeah, it's the same judge, Judge Boyce. So I know that he wasn't wanting cameras in the courtroom for her trial. And, you know, there were different reasons kind of that people thought maybe why that was the case. I don't know if he ever said outright, but I think it had to do with, you know, just making sure with how big of a case this was that it stayed away from being a spectacle, if you will, and more, you know, so the jury could stay focused. But then I think because so many people showed up, and I mean, we were having tickets they were giving us, you know, to get your seats in the room and the overflow. I'm wondering if that factored into the decision to allow it to be live streams, because then you don't have to have people travel across the country, you know, to be there in person to report on it. They can watch the live stream. If anyone is just interested in the trial, you know, they don't have to spend that money on a plane ticket. They can just stay home. And so I'm kind of wondering if, after the way things played out last year, that factored into that decision this time.
And Lauren, you and I have talked about the death penalty in this case, but let me ask you this as a reporter, did it surprise you that the government chose to pursue the death penalty on Chad when they didn't with Lori. I mean, did that just knowing the facts of the case, and you know it as well as anybody, both of their relative culpability, did it surprise you that they're pursuing that with him?
No, and I know you and I have, you know, talked about it at length too in different interviews, and I think that there were some factors with Lori and, you know, her mental capability. You know, she was, like you had mentioned, incompetent, found incompetent for a while before competency was restored. And, you know, that could play a factor in that. I know ultimately what removing the death penalty in her case was pinned upon evidence that was presented, I think, too late or after a deadline that the prosecution presented. Obviously, they would make sure that everything was absolutely correct for Chad. So that wouldn't happen. But I think in terms of their roles or their alleged roles, it's a little bit different. You don't have that mental competency factoring into it. For him, you have that additional murder charge, first degree murder charge for his late wife, Tammy, which you did not have for Lori. So I think there's enough of those differences. And, you know, again, with that late evidence that ultimately kind of led to the death penalty being pulled from her case, that the prosecution, you know, absolutely made sure everything was buttoned up for his.
Lori's youngest, JJ, it was one of the victims. And as we recall at her trial, that JJ's grandfather, Larry Woodcock, was very present, was very vocal. You had a chance to talk to him about this case, and I don't know if you can share much of that with us, but is he, he was quite a personality and a very interesting man. What did he have to say about Chad's trial, if it's any different than Lori's?
I just talked to him about that. You know, they're getting ready to come up here. They won't be here, you know, on jury selection day one, but they will be up here, and they will be in the courtroom every single day. You know, they didn't know, you know, Kay and Larry did not know Chad. They have never, you know, met him in any sort of formal way except sitting in court behind, you know, where he's at. So I think that is one major difference, is they had that relationship with Lori. They trusted Lori. That hits them differently than Chad being on trial and someone that they had absolutely no prior history with, who wasn't a caretaker, you know, to their grandson and wasn't a parental figure to their grandson. So he kind of expressed that he really feels for Chad's family, that, you know, the position that they're in, and, you know, his thoughts are kind of more with their family, because I think for him, you know, this is just round two of the justice system, and hoping, you know, for them that the justice system, you know, plays out in a fair way. And as far as the death penalty, because that wasn't a factor for Lori, he actually said that he feels like it is more of a punishment if somebody lives out life in prison versus if, you know, let's say Chad is found guilty, the jury decides death penalty. You know, if you're taking someone's life away, then that's it. It's gone in a moment. And so he kind of expressed, that he feels like maybe more of a punishment would be something like life versus the actual death penalty. But at the same time, trusting the process and the justice system, and said ultimately, you know, whatever's decided, you know, for him, hopefully guilt, but beyond that, they would respect the decisions that are made.
Has the judge indicated, Lauren, that how long this trial is expected to go? We know that in a death penalty case, and you and I talked about this the other day, it's a longer jury selection process. It's a bifurcated trial where you have the guilt phase and the penalty phase. And I forget how long Lori's trial went, but it seems it was probably about 4 weeks. Is Chad's expected to go longer than that?
Yeah, I think hers with that 1 week of jury selection ended up being about, I think it was exactly 5, if I remember correctly. And the estimate was a 4 to 6 window, so it was right in there. Chad's, the estimate is 8 to 12. And we know that his attorney plans to present witnesses and put on more of a defense than we saw in Lori's case. And I think that will be a factor as well, as we don't know how many witnesses, we don't know what kinds of forensic experts or anything that Chad's attorney would end up calling. And so, you know, we don't know, in Lori's case, it was less than a day, you know, that her defense attorneys were up there I'm not sure if his will be a few days, a week or two. So that will, you know, also play into things. But I think that 8 to 12 is the estimate that we've kind of been given all along, not only from his attorney, but from the judge.
Interesting. Well, Lauren Steinbrecher, KSL TV reporter, we will watch you and hopefully get some of your coverage when it starts. And thank you for joining us this evening on KSL
Tonight. Thank you.
And when we come back after the break, more disturbing news about the Ruby Frankie and Jody Hildebrandt cases from St. George. Stay with us.
KSL at Night.
You're back with us at KSL at Night. I'm your host this evening, KSL legal analyst Greg Skordis. This weekend, I was talking to some friends who said, hey, I want to hear your show, but I can't listen at the time. Is there a way that I can go back and look at it and or at least listen to it? Is there any other method or vehicle that I can do that? So remember, you can always go back and listen to KSL, our shows, on kslpodcast.com after the show has been aired. Just look up KSL at Night. So go to kslpodcast.com and look up KSL at Night if you want to catch any of our lost shows or shows that you missed. We're going to go, you know, this case involving Ruby Frankie and Jody Hildebrandt just continues to get worse. And if you recall, Frankie was a YouTube blogger who had millions of followers on her show, Eight Passengers. She and Hildebrandt both pleaded guilty to four counts of aggravated child abuse, which is in Utah a second-degree felony, punishable by a term of imprisonment of from 1 to 15 years. They were each sentenced to four consecutive sentences of 1 to 15 years. And we sort of think, well, the case is over. But we're learning more and more about it. We're learning more and more about the children. We see some video that was recently released, body cam video, of officers going to the house and trying to coax. Now, if you recall, there were two children involved, the son and the daughter. The son had sort of escaped and got out and got some was able to convince a neighbor that something was going on. Of course, it wasn't hard for the neighbor to see the young boy and realize something was horrible. So the police came to the house, and they really had a hard time getting the 9-year-old daughter, the 9-year-old girl, to participate. They offered her pizza. They offered to sit down and play music with her, and they did everything they could. She hesitated for a while. She finally picked up a piece of pizza because these kids were malnourished horribly. And, you know, once that was presented to her, she finally came out of the closet literally and came and started participating with the police officers. The rest is history. But we're learning more and more about it. We're learning a little bit more about Ruby Frankie's sort of mindset here and what she was thinking. We heard from Shelby Lofton, KSL TV, who said this.
In her journal, Frankie writes, she believed her children were under the influence of Satan. She writes, physical tasks were the cure. Her children were forced to do outside labor without shoes in the summer heat.
I mean, that's just incredible to me. I mean, that's just really just sickening, because if you think about it, these are her own children. These are Ruby Frankie's own son and daughter, and she's convinced that they're possessed by Satan. I mean, we talked earlier today about the Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell trial coming up. That was another reason, at least we learned in Lori's trial, why they killed the children, is because they felt that they were, I think they had some word for them, but it was the same thing, that they were possessed by the dark spirit or something like that. And once that happens, the only thing you can do is get rid of the child. Ruby Frankie did exactly what Shelby Lofton just talked about, which is, you know, just put them in a position. And we're talking about kids. We're not talking about 17, 18, although it would have been just as wrong, just as bad. But it seems like when you're talking about a 9-year-old girl, a kid of that age, to put her through what happened here, it's troubling. It's sickening. I have to hand it to the prosecutors down there in Washington County, St. George, because they held the line. They held it hard. I mean, both of these women were charged with, I think, 5 or 6 counts. They pled to 4, which means 4 times 1 to 15. I mean, they're looking at up to 60 years. If the Board of Pardons decides that they don't want these women out on the street anytime soon. They certainly have the ability to keep them there for a long time. So shifting gears just slightly to Jody Hildebrandt, Adam Small was able to pick up a recorded phone call from Hildebrandt. I'm just going to let you listen to this first, and then I'm going to comment on it afterwards.
In this mountain of evidence, there's a phone call between Hildebrandt and a woman she said she's known for years. In it, you can hear her justify her actions.
So now it's abusive to make a kid sleep on the floor. That's abusive. Or it's abusive to, you know, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Can't even raise your kids anymore.
That was not even 2 months after Frankie's 12-year-old son went to Hildebrandt's neighbor in Ivins for food and water with duct tape around his wrists and ankles. There's also body camera footage of his 10-year-old sister hesitant to talk with police, who found her sitting on a hard floor of a bathroom closet malnourished. Both women are now in prison after pleading guilty to aggravated child abuse. Adam Small, KSL News Radio.
Yeah, Jody, it's sickening that you can't discipline a child anymore. Give me a break. I mean, the more information we learn about that case, the more information we learn about the abuse that these children went through makes you just appalled at what she said. That was a recorded interview between Jody Hildebrandt and a friend of hers. You know, people who are in jail, they forget that. When you're talking to anyone except your attorney or perhaps clergy, they're listening to you. They're recording it. I mean, I have prosecutors call me all the time who say, hey, your client is spilling his guts to his girlfriend. Like, no, no, no. So she's talking to a friend of hers, justifying what she did and saying, you know, it's just troubling in this day and age that you can't discipline a kid and having a kid sleep on the floor is somehow cruel. Well, that's only part of the equation, Jody. I mean, we're talking about kids who are grossly malnourished, who are, I mean, he came, the little boy came over to the neighbor's house with duct tape on. I mean, this is not just an aggressive parental discipline situation. This is full on child abuse. The judge recognized that. The prosecutors recognized that. Even the defendant's attorneys recognized that they had little or no chance of winning at trial, and they had very skilled attorneys down there who looked at the case and said, look, we need to cut our losses here, find out a way to get some chance that these women will be released someday, but who knows how that's going to come out. We're learning more and more about that case all the time, and I'll tell you something else. It's expanding a little bit. We're learning more and more people that they indoctrinated, and we're going to hear and see some of that in the future. You just trust me, you're going to see some of that, because Hildebrandt had this plan, she had this style, she had this thing that she was teaching, and it went far more than just Ruby Frankie. And you would hope that these two women now sitting in prison will understand, will get it. They will look at themselves in the mirror someday and say, you know what? I did a horrible thing. This was not just my religious extremism and that I was trying to discipline a child who was possessed by Satan. This is me being a very bad person. They've got a lot of time to think about that. And I can assure you, based on my experience as an attorney, that the Board of Pardons is going to make sure that they understand their level of abuse, their level of cruelty, their level of complete disregard for these little kids before they're ever going to see the light of day. So interesting that we're still hearing more about these two women. Hopefully they're understanding it. Hopefully they will, you know, and it's just following up on the Chad Daybell when we talked about Lori's grandfather, JJ's grandfather, talking about, hey, maybe it's better to get the death penalty. We're talking about Chad Daybell, for him to sit in prison and think about this. These two women are going to have a lot of time to sit in prison and think about this, and let's hope they do. Some people have said they ought to have a picture of the children in their cells with them. And, you know, that would be justice. That would be justice. Of course, it's probably not the kind of thing you can force on somebody. Anyway, both out at the Utah State Prison, both serving long, multiple 1 to 15-year terms. Hopefully they will serve the greater part of that. And stay with us after the break for the second hour of KSL at Night.